but it's called School Number 9. "That certainly is one ugly building," Ed said as he steered the Land Rover towards the squat concrete block. It was exactly as had been described to them. The windows were too small and the walls too thick and coated with green slime over what must once have been whitewash. "An ugly building for an ugly purpose," Josie said. "You know they used the schools as prisons?" "Yep. Looks the part, doesn't it? Although the weather's had a good go at finishing it off." Two-thirds of the roof had collapsed, and in places the second floor looked ready to tumble into the first. There was no glass in the windows, just wooden shutters pinned back against the walls. As they drove nearer, Josie could make out evenly spaced black stumps on each windowsill, the remains of the bars that had been cut away when the building was reclaimed from Khmer Rouge in the 90s. "Why on earth did Mama Thingmy choose to meet here?" Ed's question was rhetorical, but Josie couldn't resist answering. "I think it's meant to intimidate us. They've been logging here for centuries. They don't care about climate change. They've survived a lot worse." A man emerged from a battered Nissan estate parked at the side of the building. He waved his arm, indicating they should pull in alongside him. He looked as though he'd been about to leave. As he approached, Josie held her expression with difficulty when she saw his face. A cleft ran across his right cheek from under his eye to the edge of his mouth, pulling his eye down and the corner of his mouth up. His nose twisted to the right to meet it. "Liu Mao," he said, acknowledging Ed's outstretched hand with a nod, but not taking it. "No meeting today. Mamadim has gone home now. Meet tomorrow." He took Josie's rucksack from her hand and turned towards the door of the building. "You will stay here," he said. Ed caught hold of Josie's elbow, pulling her back. He whispered, widening his eyes theatrically, "Perhaps we should sleep in the Land Rover." Josie brushed his arm away. "Don't be pathetic," she said. "Anyway, it would be insulting to turn down their hospitality." Inside, Josie's nose twitched involuntarily at the smell of ingrained damp. Liu lit an oil lamp with some difficulty. The dampness pervaded everything, even the matches. "No food, sorry," he said. But Josie was relieved, though she wouldn't have admitted it to Ed. No food meant no stomach problem later. "No problem," Ed said, raising his rucksack. "We're always prepared, like girl guides." But the joke fell flat. There was a gloomy room on the left, set out with a long table and chairs ready for the meeting that they were now too late for. "Night is coming," Liu said, walking past the door. "I will show you where to sleep. You will sleep together, yes?" Josie shook her head rather more forcefully than necessary. The furrow across Liu's face deepened. Liu led the way through a series of dank, empty rooms to a stairwell. As they walked, Josie heard faint scurrying noises that might have been small mice or large cockroaches. The stairway was concrete, rising up from below ground. It was remarkably intact compared to the rest of the building, and Josie concluded it was under the part of the roof that had survived. At the top of the stairs, Liu crossed the landing and opened the first door. "This room okay," he said. And Josie was surprised to see that it was indeed okay. It was about 4 metres square with rush matting on the floor and a low narrow bed. Her eyes were drawn to a 1930s curved dressing table against the far wall. "Mama stays here some nights for early morning logging," Liu explained. Then he paused, looking from Josie to Ed and then back again. "This only good room," he said. Ed took a look at Josie's face and laughed. "Don't worry," he said, stepping past Liu to open the door opposite. "I don't mind roughing it a bit." Liu reached out to stop him opening the door, but he was too late. Ed's words tailed off as the light from the lamp lit up the second room. If anything, it was superior to the first. It had a polished wood floor, and Josie glimpsed a broad metal-framed bed with a thick mattress before Liu stepped forward and pulled the door closed. "No," he said, "you do not want to sleep there. It's too much Khmer." Ed leant against the closed door. "What do you mean?" But Liu was bussing them back into the first room. "You will sleep here, you and you," he said, without looking at either of them. "I will also be back tomorrow. It's only a few hours." He nodded to Ed. "You come with me now with the lamp, and then you bring it back up," he said, and set off down the stairs, closely followed by Ed, who turned back on the third step to wink at Josie. "I can't resist a mystery," he said, and followed Liu down as Josie dug in her rucksack for her torch. She went back to the door of the second room and pushed it open again. Unlike the first room, it was hexagonal in shape. What she had missed earlier was that there were deep shelves along the walls, which oddly started at waist height and continued up to the ceiling. The shelves were empty. Through the open shutters opposite the door, she could see the tops of trees and distant hills. She stepped forward for a closer look, and was standing at the window when she heard Ed coming up the stairs. "You really don't want to sleep in here," he said, with an off-kilter smile, as he tugged her out of the room and let the door close. "Apparently two separate people have topped themselves by jumping out of that window in the middle of the night." "Well, that's sad, but I don't think depression is catching," she said, leaning back against the forbidden door. "Lew reckons it's what's in there that drove them to it. He says that was the commandant's room, and as Lew puts it, it has a bad spirit smell. He was dead keen to get out of here before dark." "Rubbish." Josie's irritation simmered. "That's all nonsense, and you know it. Everywhere we go in this country, there's some story about evil spirits. I'm fed up with it. The whole building smells, and I can't see that this room will be any worse than yours. I'm certainly not sleeping with you in that single bed." Ed laughed as Josie snatched up her rucksack, but then he grew serious again. "Don't sleep in there just because you're annoyed with me. It might be better to be safe than sorry. I can sleep in the Land Rover if it bothers you that much. You can lend me your torch." "I'm perfectly safe," Josie said, pushing the room door open with her back. "Sleep well." Besides, she thought, he was only across the corridor. Not that she'd admit it if she did feel spooked. She turned round to face the room. "Do your worst," she said aloud. And then she set the torch down on the floor by the bed. She soon realised why the room was described by Lew as having a bad spirit smell. The damp from the rest of the building seemed to have pervaded the blankets on the bed. She pulled out the microfiber sheet she had in her rucksack and spread it over the blankets, tucking it in under the mattress to seal off the smell. And then she pulled a sweatshirt on over her jeans and t-shirt. That would have to do. As the last of the light faded, she crossed to the shutters. She didn't much like the night noises of Southeast Asia. Too many whistles and grunts for her liking. She reached out and pulled them closed, sealing off the last of the light. She read by the torch until she fell asleep, her book sliding down onto the wooden floor by the bed with a dull thud. She dreamt she was still reading, lying in the hammock at Son Yam, but then she felt her body moving inexplicably to the left. Not dramatically, but slowly and steadily. At first she thought it was just the hammock swinging further than usual, but there was no return swing to the right. And then she realised that she was in bed and the microfiber sheet was moving under her body. She could feel it sliding away as though it was being sucked over the bottom left corner of the bed and onto the floor. Instinctively, she dug her fingers into it, trying to hold it steady. At the same time, she became aware of a cold wind blowing across her body from right to left, matching the growing chill within her. The air blew faster and colder. It wasn't coming from the direction of the window or the door. Now it seemed to be beneath her, forcing the sheet up, lifting her from underneath, rolling her onto her right side. She tried to anchor herself by reaching for the metal frame of the bed, but her arms wouldn't move. Suddenly, and without warning, she felt herself thrown up from the bed by force, as though repelled by the mattress. She opened her eyes and was so close to the ceiling that she would have been able to reach out her hand and touch it if she could have moved her arm. Then another force took her and pushed her aside and down past the edge of the bed onto the floor. Dashed into a heap by the bed, the microfiber sheet still caught in her clenched hand. She felt a cold and raw evil deep inside herself. She caught her breath and held it. The chilled feeling held steady. And recognition slowly began to dawn. She concentrated and then calmly tried to force a scream in the back of her throat. She pushed the scream out mentally and physically, but only a forced emerged. She felt relief. There was no sound because her mouth was clenched shut, forced into stillness by the sleeping paralysis that keeps us all safe while we dream. A fragment of her conscious mind was awake, but her body was still asleep. It had been a long time, but she knew what to do now. She strained to raise herself up through the levels of sleep. Gradually, the chill wind dropped, and she became aware again that she was lying still on the bed and not heaped on the floor. The microfiber sheet was still in place, although it was indeed clenched in her hand. She concentrated carefully on that hand and then slowly and deliberately opened her fingers. Her breath was coming sharply and her heart was still beating fast, but she was awake and the sense of cold evil was fading. She lay there, trying to get her bearings in the room. She remembered what her mother used to say to calm her down. "There's nothing there in the dark that wasn't there when the light was on." She breathed out heavily. There was no light in the room. It felt like 3:10 in the morning. She'd never understood why she knew the time on occasions like this, but she invariably did, as though her body contained a digital device that was tuned to the 24-hour clock, wherever she was in the world. She turned over and her stomach pressed against the mattress. She needed the bathroom. The There was one in the stairwell, primitive, but beggars couldn't be choosers. She stretched her legs out to the end of the bed and curled her feet over the metal frame, taking her time and feeling the ornamental ridges under her toes. She sat up slowly and twisted round, placing her feet on the wooden floor. She stood up, took a step forward, her arms stretched out in front of her. After two paces, her fingers brushed against one of the shelves. She took hold of it and rang her finger a little way along its surface. She had expected it to be thick with dust, but it felt clean. She had overshot the door. She turned to her left, tapping with her hand against the edge of the shelf, feeling for the gap. After a couple of paces, she winced as her shin hit the metal frame of the bed. But how could she have missed the door? Perhaps it was further away from the bed than she remembered. She turned and began to make her way clockwise round the room, with her left hand tapping the edge of the shelf by her waist. After several steps, she reached a gap, but as she felt for the handle, she realised she was at the shutters. She had been sure the door was to her left as she lay on the bed. She must have been mistaken. She carried on clockwise around the room, and after another few moments, she stubbed her toe against the metal bed again and leant her hands down, finding herself holding the edge of her torch. Of course, that was where she'd left it. She pushed the button up, but it wouldn't go. She pushed it down and then up again. Nothing. She must have fallen asleep with it on, damn. But at least she knew where she was in the room, even if she couldn't find the door. She sat down on the bed. Despite herself, she felt her heart picking up speed again. This was bonkers. She stood up and walked slowly around the room again, this time anti-clockwise, running her right hand along the edge of the shelf above the one that she had used the first time round. She reached the shutters, and then, after a few more places, she was again at the other side of the bed without reaching the door. She sat down again. This was all highly confusing. She really did need to go to the loo. She tried to retrieve the feeling of the night terrors when a part of her brain knew she was sleeping. They were always so realistic, so perhaps she was still sleeping now. It was the only thing that made sense. She tried the scream test again, but this time her real scream echoed round the room and she clamped her mouth shut, embarrassed. Any minute Ed would come bursting through the door wondering what on earth was happening, and he would never believe she wasn't scared. The thought of Ed coming in reminded her that there was indeed a door, and there had to be a sensible reason why she couldn't find it. Perhaps the shelves are fixed to the back of the door and unfold into place when the door is shut, she thought. Comforted by this particularly rational explanation, Josie stood up again and walked confidently towards the place where she believed the door to be. She reached the shelves and spread her hands across it, and sure enough, her hand knocked against something smooth and round, the door handle. She pulled it towards her and was surprised that it came away in her hand. Now she was going to have to fix it in the dark. She felt it with both hands. But this wasn't a door handle. It was a smooth round end of something long and thin. She felt along the length and found another smooth round end. She held the ends in each hand, stroking the smoothness with her fingers, and then realization dawned and she dropped it, a sudden coldness dropping through her centre at the same time. It was a bone. Suddenly she was swamped by the feeling from childhood that a hand would come out from under the bed and grab her ankle. She stepped backwards quickly to where she knew the bed to be, but it wasn't there. She took another step backwards, but again, it wasn't there. She felt terror. Her body began to involuntarily curl up, even though she was still standing. Standing like that on the polished wooden floor, she wet herself. She heard it hiss and spatter on the wood and felt the warm wetness underfoot at the same time as the damp patch on the inside of her jeans was already turning cold. Even in her fear, she was embarrassed. She would have to clean that up in the morning. But standing in the room in the dark, she didn't know what to do. She dropped to her knees and felt away from the damp floor with her hands, found her way over to the wall. She was under the shelving now, and she turned so that her back was against the plaster and her front facing the room. She edged her way around the room to her left until she felt a slight breeze coming from the crack around the edge of the shutters above her head. She felt something bumping against her arm and raised her hand. It was a metal ring. She ran her fingers cautiously round it until she felt the chain from which it was hanging. She stopped then, holding onto the chain, scared to go on. What used to happen in this room? Unbidden, she pictured Liu, his face mangled like the car crash victim denied plastic surgery, fixed to the chain on the wall while the commandant slept. Did he leave them there until they starved to death? The smell of her urine came to her. How many people had urinated on that floor, or worse? She became aware of scratching from the other side of the room, not the random scratch of an animal, but more like fingernails on concrete. Damn her imagination. She needed air. She stood up and pressed against the shutters, but they were stuck fast. She drew in all her strength and lunged forwards. The shutters burst open and she swung out through them, scrabbling at the air, her hips tilting over the windowsill. This was how these two people had died, not suicide at all. As she teetered on the edge of the sill in the grey pre-dawn light, she grabbed sideways at the hook which should have held the shutters back. With her other hand, she reached back and took hold of the stub of an iron bar poking up from the windowsill. She steadied herself, still stretched out from fingertip to hip, a 20-metre drop onto the concrete. Slowly, she edged her body back into the room, first her toes and then the balls of her feet on the floor, and she straightened up, resting for a moment against the sill before turning back to face the room. In the low light, she saw the dark patch on the wooden floor and also the bed. She looked up to pick out the door, but all around the room were the shelves. In horror, she realised they were no longer empty, but stacked high with bleached bones. Her breath caught in her chest, but before she could scream, a force hit from behind and she was propelled forwards. Her face crashing into the urine-soaked wood, she tasted blood on her lip as she heard the shutters slam shut behind her and the dim light disappeared. The scratching started again nearer her head, and now she could hear a metallic sound from behind her beneath the window. She opened her lungs, but even as she was screaming, at the back of her mind she remembered she had screamed earlier that night, and no one had come.